All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to jump right into things today because we got a solid, packed show, all right? At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Roger Genver-Smith about his play, Frederick Douglass Now. Before that, we will be concentrating an entire half hour on the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. We're going to be joined by Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, who is in Missouri now, as well as Joey Johnson, who is also from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the October 22nd Coalition, and he's reporting from Ferguson. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Anthony Gray, who is one of the lawyers for the family of Michael Brown, the young man who was brutally killed by the police in Ferguson, Missouri. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's talk about this. The legal team for the family of Michael Brown has said they're uncertain that the police in St. Louis County can provide a fair and impartial investigation. And you've said that you have misgivings about the objectivity of law enforcement in St. Louis County.
That is true, sir. And the reason being, when this incident initially occurred, there were statements released from the police department from St. Louis County that were completely skewed, one-sided, some would say totally lopsided in favor of the officer, which at that point told me that they've lost their investigatorial objectivity. And so I've been suspect ever since I've heard the initial reports of what happened.
It actually is very heavy, exactly what you're saying. You know, when you think about it, I've read things where when Michael Brown was killed, that there were a number of eyewitnesses who came forward, a couple of them at least,
yes.
And they weren't even interviewed by the police who were supposedly investigating what happened, right?
Exactly. And not only at that point had they not been interviewed, when the chief gave his initial press conference, you would not have even known that there were witnesses outside broad daylight on a Saturday afternoon. You would have thought that everybody was in bed asleep. And it was amazing for him to just give this version of events that only depicted what was going through the mind of the officer. So you're very right about what you stated. And that, to me, has touched off the furor that you see coming from the people.
What do you mean? Speak about that a little bit.
I think the initial reaction from the community was, number one, you got an unarmed young African-American man that shot and killed. Okay, so we're tired of that just as a general notion. That just upsets us. But then when you get some of the eyewitnesses that then say he had his arms up as a universal sign of surrender, then that just sets off a fury in individuals that, in my opinion, can't be stopped until it's acknowledged and something is done about it. I want you to think about something. Some of the most hardened criminals in the world are in jail right now, Charles Manson and the like, because they displayed the universal sign of surrender. They gave in to the police. When they gave that sign, they took him into custody peacefully. Charles Manson wasn't shot and killed at the site in which he was taken into custody. So that, to me, is what got people around the world so upset about what they're hearing about this incident. Black, white, Hispanic, and I think you would see the same outcry had this been a Chinese guy or a white guy with his hands up in the air, and witnesses are saying that a police officer unloaded his weapon while he was in that position. You would see the same thing no matter where it happened.
Absolutely. Now, tell me this, Anthony. I keep wondering, it can't be that this case, what happened to Michael Brown, is like really unique in Ferguson. From what I've seen, from what I've read, it seems like it has a lot of the character of, in terms of the relationship with the police and whatnot, and the whole authority structure. It seems to have the character a lot like, you know, one of the old South African townships under apartheid rule in South Africa, or the way that Michael and his friend were walking down the street and he was killed because they continued to walk down in the street and the cop decided he was going to throw down with him. You know, what is the situation for, you know, broadly speaking, for, you know, black youth of anywhere in Ferguson?
Well, here's the thing. The evidence is beginning to show that these officers don't have a sense of serving the communities in which pay their salary. They come here, some of them drive in a half hour, hour, 2 hours to work in what has been characterized as a attitude of policing the neighborhood. In other words, I'm here to keep these people straight. I don't want a relationship. I'm not trying to develop relationships with the community. I'm putting on what you see as a blue uniform. To them, some have described as army fatigue. That's what they see in the mirror. They see themselves going to hunt as opposed to going to serve. And that's just the mentality that we're seeing reflected in these incidents. And it's got to stop.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now tell me this. How hard is it to charge a cop with straight-up homicide? And I'm raising that because I know in New York with Eric Garner, when he was killed, the city officials found it to be a homicide, but then they immediately say, well, we don't know who we could charge with homicide. Well, it would seem pretty obvious who you'd charge with homicide, but then immediately the police unions all got together and said, you know what? It wasn't the police that killed Eric Garner. It was disrespect for the police that killed Eric Garner. And I'm wondering, how difficult is it to charge a cop with straight-up homicide in Ferguson?
Well, I say the bar is set pretty high, and the reason why, and it's understandably so in some respects, they do have the authority to use deadly force. It's the deployment of that deadly force that comes under a real high scrutiny, unlike you and I, who don't have an inherent power to use it. When we discharge our weapons, it's examined on a much lower standard than it is for officers because they have the right to use it. There's an assumption that they fully train and that any deployment of a deadly force was done based on some professional training. They get the benefit of the doubt. So it's real difficult when you look at it from that perspective.
Has it ever been done?
You know what? I can't think of the last time that it's ever been done in St. Louis. I'm sure at some point in our history it may have been done, but as I talk to you right now, I cannot independently recall such an incident.
All right, Anthony, one more question. Where do things stand now?
Tensions are high, and I suspect they may even get a little bit higher because they are now rolling out pictures of allegedly Mike Brown Jr. in a convenience store having an encounter with someone allegedly right before this incident. And now the community is very suspect in the way that they're rolling this out. Again, it's almost like a character assassination of Mike, just like they're describing the assassination that took place on the street. So it is very tense. I anticipate that there will be some kind of backlash. I don't know what. I hope it's not. I hope I'm wrong about that. But if there is, this is on the police side. They can't keep blaming the folks for the rioting and the looting. They have to take ownership for inciting these people the way they're doing it.
You know, one of the things that actually, it's actually when people stand up and fight against the police murder of somebody in the community, I know that they always try to portray it as senseless rioting and looting when actually it's people refusing to accept and saying it got to stop now. One of the things when you think about Michael Brown, you know, from all accounts, he was a young guy, 18 years old, who made it his entire life without having a record, who actually did many of the things that they say, oh, you're supposed to do, you know, walk straight and, you know, get into school, all this other stuff. So, you know, it's intense when you think about this. And then they turn around now and they do what they always do, whether it's with Oscar Grant or anyone else. They do what they always do. They say they murder you first and then they murder you a second time in the press and through ruining your reputation and trying to build a justification after the fact for killing you.
Yep, exactly. And let me just say this to you, because I think people need to hear this from me. I was thinking about this yesterday. When there's rioting and looting that takes place after a sporting event, I don't hear law enforcement characterize those individuals the same way they're characterizing the folks here in St. Louis. When there's a Stanley Cup championship or there's a soccer game championship, NFL, and they go tear up a whole city and flip over police cars, you don't get this. You know, I don't remember an incident where somebody was shot and killed as a result of those sporting events. And I would just point out that those individuals don't look like the people that are looting and rioting in St. Louis.
On that note, Anthony, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
All right.
We'll stay in touch as things develop. All right.
All right. No problem. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we've just been talking with Anthony Gray, who is one of the lawyers for the family of Michael Brown, who was brutally murdered by the police in Ferguson, Missouri. Joining us now to talk more about this is Joey Johnson. Joey Johnson is part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He's also in the October 22nd Coalition, and he's a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's been in Ferguson for a while now. Joey, how are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. Good to talk with you. Sorry I'm a little hoarse right now, but I'm here.
Why you hoarse, man?
I'm hoarse because we've been out in the streets standing with the people for the last 5 days against something that should have never happened. What's profoundly different, though, unfortunately, is not that another black youth or another young black man was murdered by the police. That's becoming an everyday occurrence under this system and in this country. But what's different is that people have stood up so powerfully here for days on end now, days and nights on end. I think people all over the country have drawn tremendous inspiration from it. It's, you know, Missouri kind of sits in the center of the country, and ironically, it's put it in the center of the country or the center of the world in terms of the eyes of people all over the country and around the world being on St. Louis and Ferguson too, because of the way people have stood up.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, you've been on the scene for a few days now. What is happening?
Well, the scenes in the streets have been that the police have brought out enormous force after a profound injustice against the people, the murder of Michael Brown, which your previous guest, Anthony Gray, got into. After that profound injury to the people, then they come out with enormous force to suppress people's outrage. And it looks like a militarized city with the police in battle fatigues and driving military vehicles and blockading roads and intersections. And I mean, the vehicles they're coming out in are these armored personnel carriers with snipers on top of them, with automatic rifles, automatic weapons. And some of them fire real bullets, which they haven't used yet, but some of them fire these rubber bullets and these wooden projectiles, and people have been badly injured from them. There's pictures on people can see them on the internet of the injuries, and this is outrageous, man, in terms of, like, people are righteously standing up against this police murder of Michael Brown in the name of more suppression. The vehicles look like the hippos that they had in apartheid South Africa to block the roads for the people to pass. And that's the memory or the imagery that it conjures up. But I've just been tremendously inspired by the courage, the young people. You know, so many people talk about how the young people and black youth and what have you are in a degraded position, you know, around the country. But seeing them stand up, you know, it's so true about when people raise their heads and fight back that they begin to think about things and come together and unite. It's a very good situation. And I've been waiting a long time to see something like this. Well, I'm very proud to be here standing with the people and bringing them both the Stop Mass Incarcerations Month of Resistance against all of this mass incarceration, police terror, the criminalization of a generation, and letting them know that they're not alone, that this is going on nationwide, that we were working on this even before Michael Brown was murdered. We've been working on it some time because this needs to happen. It is an emergency situation. There is this new Jim Crow. There is this slow genocide that's gathering momentum that has to be stopped. And people have been so receptive and excited to meet us and excited that we came from other places in the country. I came from Oakland to come here to stand with the people, and other folks have come from Chicago, and people come from different cities to stand together with them. And then I'm also like bringing them the Revolution newspaper and the work of Bob Avakian and talking about how there's a whole vision for a different society. We don't have to live this way. And so important connections are being made. But it's on a foundation of really thousands of people being in the street every night, defiant against concussion grenades and tear gas and batons and these checkpoints and just, you know, unconscionable violence against the people by the system.
Well, tell me this, Joey. One of the things that's getting posed up a lot, and by many forces, it's getting posed up a lot, is this point about it being a situation that, you know, when I looked at it, I was reminded as well of the townships in South Africa, the hippos, the military police roaming through the townships, pot shots at people, all these kinds of things that are going on. Even the use of the weaponry and the look of all this, it was very, 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 very just painful, but, you know, painful and enraging sort of similarity to what happened in apartheid South Africa and happens in many places under the boot of U.S. imperialism around the world. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is that there seems to be a big argument going on around this, painting the situation as being the problem being that it's overly militarized police with attitudes versus looters and vandals. I see it in the LA Times. I see it in the New York Times. It's like, Well, the looters and vandals are the people that are coming out and taking advantage of this. The cops that they bring in, the highway patrol. We're not going to allow looters and vandals to deal with this. Or, you know, Obama's messages. All these things about there's, you know, when he starts off with there's absolutely no excuse for, you know, anyone fighting with the police or whatever, you know. And you think about this, and they're really posing this as sort of the police. And the problem is, yes, they're overly militarized, but, you know, it's a tough job. They got to, somebody's got to do it. And then there's vandals and looters, and the great masses of people are somewhere in between being victimized by both.
Well, first, let's start with reality and how they're distorting it and how they're trying to characterize why people are doing what they're doing, how they're trying to divert people's attention. The reality is the mass incarceration, 2.5 million people, the increasing police terror that's used, the whole characterization of black youth as a criminal, pariah class of young people, or thugs and hoodlums, for whom there's no place in this society. This has been something that's been in the works for a long time, because we're talking about a system that has no future for millions and millions of youth in the inner city. It goes all the way back to what Michelle Alexander said in the book, The New Jim Crow, about the meeting that Nixon had, saying that, let's face it, black people are the problem. Let's find a way to deal with that without saying that. And the war on drugs and the war on crime, it goes on with the transferring of millions of manufacturing jobs overseas. And so just having no place to profitably exploit a whole new generation coming up. And so then they criminalize them. And they're not going to blame their system. They're going to blame the youth. And that's what they've been doing in a systematic way, including developing all this weaponry and new forms of repression to suppress the youth. They see these youth, they want them warehoused in the prisons. They don't want their defiance. They don't want their rebellious attitude out in society. I know it gets expressed in negative ways sometimes, but that's not fundamentally the underlying problem, is the system having no future for the youth. And so they're developing a whole genocidal program and trying to unite other sections of society around it. And that's completely intolerable. And look, this thing about the looting, like one of the youth said to me on the street the other night, he said, before the looting, there was the shooting, you know? What preceded what? And even behind a lot of the looting is a lot of pain and suffering. People have to understand what's going on with this murder is a lot of pent-up anger and suffering that's gone on for things that have gone on for decades. Brutality, harassment, the things that the police say to people here when they pull them over, the racist, I can't repeat this stuff on the air. And these are the things that people have told us. People have told us their story, lifted their shirts and showed us where they were shot by the police, and their whole torso is one long stitch. We're talking about something that's accumulated over decades. That's why it exploded so powerfully. If it had just been one person, it would not explode with this kind of ferocity. So let's get to the heart of the issue. That's what it's about. That's what people have risen up against.
All right, Joey, we're going to bring Carl Dix on right now, and I want to thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
All right, man, so we'll talk to you again soon. And people can read updates from and reportage on what's going on in Ferguson at revcom.us and Revolution Newspaper. Carl Dix is a frequent guest on the show. He's also a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he is part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And together with Cornel West, Carl has called for a month of resistance to mass incarceration, to police brutality, to the whole genocidal assault on black and Latino youth in this country. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, man. Well, let's jump into this. You've forcefully argued. You've been listening to some of the stuff that's going on. You're down in Missouri now, followed this very closely, and you've been also neck deep involved in the stuff that's going on in New York and other cities around the country. Let's talk about this. You forcefully argued that this, the rampant murder that's going on of black and Latino youth, the mass incarceration, all this, that this must stop now. This whole idea of somehow arguing that it's not right to stand up and resist around this stuff. And you've argued that actually it's absolutely essential, that it must stop now. It has to stop now, and it has to be done by the people themselves. Let's talk about that.
What people need to realize is that what we are dealing with are not isolated incidents, but a whole program of repression and oppression and that it must be stopped. I mean, we're talking about a program that has genocidal implications when we put together the police murders that are going on all across the country, the way in which the police almost never get punished in any way for them. You put that together with the 2 million plus people that are incarcerated in a new Jim Crow, the 5 million people who were formerly incarcerated but are now being treated like less than full human beings, and the loved ones of all of these people. You got tens of millions of people who are caught up in this. This is a program with genocidal implications. And let's just look at it. You know, Eric Garner, choked to death by cops in New York City, Staten Island, caught on video. So far, the only people who've been arrested who are associated with this case are the brother named Mr. Orta, who took the video, and his wife. They're the only people who've been arrested because no cops have been busted, even though it is right there on video. Or Michael Brown, gunned down by a cop, and they finally named the guy, but don't tell me that I got some victory because you named the cop that killed him. The cop that killed him needs to be indicted, convicted, and sent to jail. That's the demand here. It ain't enough to tell us his name. Put him on trial for his murderous action. That's what needs to go down. But see, it reminded me of the state of things back in the old Jim Crow, when they would lynch a black person for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that would be a message to all of the other black people. This could be done to you if you get out of line or if you do anything that rubs us the wrong way. See, and that's the message that's being put out. When Michael Brown's mother talked about all the hard work that Michael had done, the hard work that she and her husband had done to get him through high school, ready to go to college, and then he's snatched away. And she talked about what kind of message that sends to the youth. It says, we're not going to let you get nowhere. You get a little leg up, and we're going to snatch it back. So that's what we're up against. And everybody with an ounce of justice in their heart has to see this for what it is and join us in saying this must stop, and it must stop now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And Carl is currently down in Ferguson standing with the people in their fight against the horrendous police murder of Michael Brown. Well, tell me this, though, Carl, because, you know, again, it still comes up and you have every element that could be called on to do this is being brought in. And it becomes, you know, from Sharpton, who's going around talking about, and he really is, you know, he plays this role of bringing out a fire hose in a way to cool down the people, you know, and I do mean the comparison, if you want to take the comparison with fire hoses in the 60s used against black people fighting against Jim Crow, and then you have Sharpton come up and using a fire hose to cool out the anger and the resistance of the people to actually lead them in a different direction. It's amazing. Wherever this happens, where things get very hot, he's there immediately, and it's really there to suppress the kind of resistance, or to suppress the youth in particular, and what the system calls vandals and looters. You know, I wanted to ask you about this because you have argued very clearly, and you were hitting at this now, you know, you can't rely on official investigations and finding ways to cool things off. And too many people, I think, are saying the problem is we have to step back and get our heads straight. We actually have to chill down a little bit. We have to actually step back and allow the things to, we'll keep our eyes on what's going on, but allow the system to function. And it seems to me what you're saying is the system functioning is murdering and allowing the police to get off like this and all the rest of this.
Yeah, see, that's exactly the point. I mean, Bob Avakian says that the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people, but to serve and protect the system that exists by exploitation and oppression of the great majority of the people. And that's the reality that we're dealing with. And they come at us in a lot of different ways. Joey was talking about, and Attorney Gray was talking about how they came at people with military force in the first few days, trying to beat people back in place. And that didn't work. And in the midst of that, they came with some other things. Sharpton came out and said, we got to be respectful. We got to be peaceful. We got to be calm. And see, what I say to that is that responsible Negro leaders like that need to get out of the way, because these young people here did what was needed. They saw one of their own murdered, and they had a history of brutalizing and murdering black people and getting away with it. And the youth said, no, this time we are not going to take this on our knees. They stood up, they fought back, and they changed the way that people, not only in this country but around the world, look at the U.S. and how it functions and the way that it works. There were people in Gaza tweeting to people in Ferguson about how to handle tear gas. This is what impact this had around the world. And that even forced them to the powers that be to change up a little bit. You got Obama talking about, well, this is a time for healing and peace and calm. Well, no, Obama, you are wrong. This is not a time for healing and peace and calm. This is a time for stepping up the struggle. And like I said, don't tell me we got something because they named the cop. When the cop is indicted and in jail for the murder that he carried out, then we're talking about some justice. And that's what's got to be fought for. And this struggle for justice has got to be connected to the fight against all of the injustice that this criminal injustice system brings down. The Eric Garners in New York, the Brother Ford in California, and a lot of other people that I can't, you know, I can't name everybody.
I want to talk about that point in particular in a little bit, but I want to ask you, I want to follow up a little bit more on this question of Obama, because, you know, you look at it, and this was really intense. I mean, Obama issued, what, 3 statements or so on the situation in Ferguson? I mean, it indicates something, you know, that seems like there's something in the air. There's something has shifted around this in a way, you know, and I'm not trying to make it, you know, seem like it's, you know, like, oh, this is sort of the Rubicon, but there's actually something has shifted in the atmosphere. Something has actually, you know, one, the people in Ferguson and how they've stood up around this, what you're saying about the impact of things like how to withstand tear gas, the way that people all over the world are looking at this and people all over this country are looking at it. And it just really struck me as like, when was the last time that a president of the U.S. actually stood up and issued 3 statements and said immediately, I'm sending Eric Holder and I'm sending the U.S. attorney, I'm getting the U.S. attorney's office involved, all this stuff. And it's almost like this question of the legitimacy has really been placed front and center in a way.
Exactly. That's exactly the question that's up. Because, one, they felt that they could easily contain the young people, especially in the masses of people here in Ferguson, and that did not work. People just kept coming back. And then you have the world looking at the U.S. police firing tear gas and rubber bullets at people protesting a murder. You've got the world looking at U.S. police arresting journalists, firing tear gas at journalists. So the powers that be said, oh, we got to change this one up. The mouthpieces for the capitalist rulers had to change this one up and say, oh, well, this is a time for healing and peace and calm. You know, they had to step back because their legitimacy was being torn apart around the world. People were seeing that the U.S. that tries to masquerade as the defender of human rights was brutalizing and oppressing people openly right here in the U.S. And then at the same time, people here were standing up, and it was opening the eyes of people all around the country. So they had to back up some. But again, we are still dealing with a genocidal program. And some talk about healing and peace and calm does not get it, because we cannot heal. You can't have peace if that's supposed to be on the basis of the continued brutal oppression of black people and Latino people and everything else foul that this system stands for. So people have to not ease off in the struggle, not think that we've gained what we were going for. But in fact, this is the time to step it up. And that's why I came down. I came down with Juanita Young from New York, Parents Against Police Brutality, Uncle Bobby, Oscar Grant's uncle, has been down here. Other people are coming because this is concentrating the fight against this genocidal program. We got to link that up with the fight all across the country, which we're going to make a big leap in with the October month of resistance to mass incarceration. And then the other thing that I'm bringing to people is that this is built into the fabric of this system, and it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of it once and for all. And we are going to fight with everybody to take up the resistance. We're going to call on everybody to join the resistance to these vicious, brutal attacks and help the young people, especially here, to continue to stand up and to open their eyes and to bring to them that there's a way out of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, let me ask you this. I want to ask you something I'm thinking about. You know, I saw Roger Gember Smith's play, Frederick Douglass Now, about a week ago. There was a point in there where he talks about Frederick Douglass. He says, without struggle, there's no progress. But more, he also goes on to add to what Douglass said, or Douglass's words. He brings it more words out, saying, what people will quietly submit to is an exact measure of the injustice and wrongs that will be heaped upon the oppressed. Who is to be free must strike the blow. That seems to me to concentrate a lot of sort of things, both on the immediate level of the, you know, the fight against these particular manifestations, but also on the bigger level in terms of what you're talking about, don't you think?
That's what makes this moment so important, because brutal oppression, foul police murders like this has become the norm. And in fact, in talking with people here, I've been talking with Joey and some of the youth who came down from Chicago with the Revolution Club, and they've talked about how a lot of the people that they've been out in the streets with have stories of their own victimization at the hands of the police or the victimization of others. But see, what this is, though, is an opening here where people stood up, where people fought back, and where they're saying, no more. This has got to stop. And that has to be united with, built on, given broader and more determined expression. And people everywhere who see these injustices need to be connected with it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what brought myself, some of the others. I even didn't mention some of the folks that came down. You know, Travis Morales from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network in New York came down. The Downs family, whose son was murdered by a cop in Stockton, California, they came. And the last time all of us were together was at the strategizing session, where we issued the call for the month of resistance to mass incarceration back, this coming October. But now we're here together with people fighting against these manifestations of police terror and connecting that with the fight against this criminal injustice system overall.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, we're going to have to move on, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, and one thing, people want to find out more about Stop Mass Incarceration. They can read stuff about stuff that you're writing and statements you've made on revcom.us. But to get information on the Month of Resistance and Stop Mass Incarceration, where can they go?
They can go to the website stopmassincarceration.net.
All right, Carl, thank you very much. Look forward to talking to you again soon. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Before we move into our second half of the show, which is going to focus up around a play by Roger Gember Smith called Frederick Douglass Now, I want to read something from Revolution Newspaper. And it's something I think that is extremely important, and people should check it out, think about it. Let me know what you think about this when you hear it, all right? We stand with the defiant ones. We stand with the defiant ones. We stand with the angry ones, the rebellious ones, the ones who will not take it, the ones who tell the truth, and the ones they lie about. Without defiance, without rage, without righteous rebellion, without people insisting on their rights and defending those rights in the street, very few people would even know about Michael Brown and how he was shot over and over with his hands up, murdered by pigs, and then left to lie there in the streets as if he were an animal. Very few people would have shared the grief of his parents for the terrible loss of this young man at the very beginning of his life. Without this rebellion, this terrible state-done murder would just be another rerun of the same old, all-too-familiar story, the same murderous stuff that happens to Black and Latino youth over and over again. But because of the defiance and rebellion, the whole world knows the story. Now everybody has to deal with this. And people all over the country and all over the world support this fight. You, the defiant ones, are changing the thinking of millions and millions of people. You are calling out to everyone not to take it. You are making history in the way it badly needs to be made. So yes, we stand with the defiant ones, and we will defend them and stand with them in deed as well as in word. But now the authorities bring in the National Guard. This just shows how scared those on top are of the people that they oppress and dog from day one down to today. The National Guard is just another part of their whole illegitimate use of force and violence against the people expressing their rights. And any illegal, unconstitutional, and illegitimate actions of the National Guard can and must be defied too. The people's righteous demands have not been met. This cop, this murdering pig, must be charged and taken into custody now. This pig chief must be fired. And right now, the people must be allowed to stay in the streets and express themselves in no uncertain terms. Sunday night, as the tear gas hung in the air and the time ticked down to the midnight curfew, a woman stepped up and started calling out to the people, "No justice, no curfew." In response to the call to go home and get some rest, she said, "Michael Brown can't get no rest. He can't go home. We're not going home." This is the spirit of Ferguson. This is the spirit we need to support and spread. To everyone who really wants liberation, who wants a better day for our youth, don't let them tamp this down. To the leaders who attack the angry ones and tell us to trust in the system, no. If you can't do any better than that, get out of the way. And to any so-called militants who shamefully take up the role of the police and decide who can protest and when, who attack and slander the agitators and the communists as provocateurs, you need to cut that COINTELPRO ish out. And if you can't stand with the people when they stand up, then just get on home. Stand together and demand real justice. The time is now. Once again, that was a statement called "We Stand with the Defiant Ones," and you'll find that on revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Roger Genver Smith talking about his play, Frederick Douglass Now. Don't miss this. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're now talking with Roger Genver Smith. Roger, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks for having me.
You know, here's the thing, man. I was playing that song and I thought it's so tied in with, you know, Steel Pulse, State of Emergency, so tied in with what we've been talking about the first half of the show, as well as what's concentrated up for a lot of people in your play.
Yeah, and United States of Emergency.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about this. I want people to know, I mean, I saw your play a week ago, and as I was telling you, I saw a piece from it back when I first came out to L.A., and it was right in the aftermath of the L.A. Rebellion, and it was over at the First AME Church.
Right.
I was knocked back then. I was just astounded in just really powerful play when I saw it the other night. I want you to tell people what Frederick Douglass Now is about.
Frederick Douglass Now is about if there is no struggle, there is no progress, because that was the rap of Brother Frederick Douglass from 1818 to 1895. MC Freddie D is still alive. No Jive, in 1985 he was alive, and then in 1986 we threw him in the mix. In 87 he was looking down from heaven. In 1988, Michael, he said, "Mash down apartheid, smash down apartheid. Mash down a smash down a bash down apartheid." In 89, he was right on time. And now it's 25 years after the release of the film, Do the Right Thing, and I still got to bust this rhyme. They love black music, but they hate black people.
That was a really intense part line in the play, and really intense in terms of in reality. You know, one of the things when you open that up, and what opens that up, that whole, just the rap that you just did, is those words, "I am a fugitive slave." You know, and then you take it, it's not just Frederick Douglass. It's people know you're playing the character Frederick Douglass, but it takes a trip through the sordid history of this entire country. Can you talk about that a little? What was behind that?
You're talking about the prologue to the show, mm-hmm. which was entitled Blood and Brains in its original form. and published in an anthology of solo performance entitled Extreme Exposure. And in it, I travel through time, through space. First lines, yes, I am a fugitive slave. Second line, I live beneath the Hollywood Freeway or the Brooklyn Bridge. You will go underneath the Hollywood Freeway and you will see people living there by any means necessary in cardboard boxes, in tents. And largely the people that we see on the street in Los Angeles in particular are people of African descent. In fact, the greatest concentrated community of black people in LA is on Skid Row. So I tell the tale of Frederick Douglass not for nostalgia's sake, not simply as an exercise in history, so-called, but as a look at the present moment, the present American moment, the present Los Angeles moment, in fact. I think that Mr. Douglass has a lot to say to us here in the City of the Angels.
You know, it's interesting. It's very heavy because when you think about it, you think about what you're talking about, the freeway and the rest of this. And you know, there's the woman that was beaten by a highway patrol cop just a few weeks ago, a grandmother who was beaten on the side of the road. You know, then you look at what happened at 65th and Broadway the other day. And one of the things that really just gets you so angry is when they were explaining why they killed this young guy, Ezell Ford, why they killed him. They said, how it got to that point, they said that they were making an investigative stop. What the hell does that mean, aside from exactly what's concentrated on what you were saying in terms of I am a fugitive slave and how it plays back in the past and very powerfully in the future for a whole people? And when they said that this guy, it was an investigative stop, what was he doing? He was walking suspiciously down the street, and he ended up dead. And, hey... That's the way it goes, and this is what too much goes on in this society. And so, when I was thinking about the title of your play, Frederick Douglass Now, and it's Frederick Douglass in the time traveling trip that's going on. But it's also, in a certain sense, there's a statement of a need and a demand for Frederick Douglass now.
I think there is, and I think there should be. I think there always will be as long as there is inequity in American society, and that's the inequity to which you have referred, which plays itself out on the streets of L.A. and the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, which, of course, is the show-me state. And they have indeed shown us that Missouri continues to be a state which is in a state of emergency. The state of Missouri is an interesting one in that it was, of course, a battleground for slavery, and it was a battleground against slavery. And it played itself out in 1857, of course, in the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott being a black man who was enslaved upon birth in Virginia. He was taken by his master, who was a resident of the state of Missouri, to a free territory. And Dred Scott immediately sued for his freedom. He and his wife, Harriet, saying that, hey, I've been in a free state. How can you return me to slavery? And it was determined in 1857 by Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, after whom I was not named, that the black person in America had no rights that the white person was bound to respect. Frederick Douglass, of course, took immediate umbrage to this statement and made a brilliant speech against the decision. But he recognized that the madness of this kind of anti-constitutional attitude in America would be its downfall. And in fact, this led to the disunion of our country, and it was articulated in this thing called the Civil War, which Frederick Douglass immediately recognized as an abolition war, a war of rebellion, a war of liberation. Unlike other people whose story was articulated by Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm.
We'll get into that. That was brilliant in that book. That was really brilliant. So, Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Roger Genver Smith about his play, Frederick Douglass Now, which for those of you who are not in a city where the play is being shown currently, if you go on YouTube, you can find it there. Just Google Frederick Douglass Now. It'll take you to YouTube, and the link will be there for you to watch the play in full. Roger, let me ask you this. There's a couple. I want to dig into some of these juxtapositions that you have in the play. The thing with Marvin Gaye singing the national anthem at an NBA championship, right? And it was the last time he sang that song, or?
It was the last time that Marvin Gaye performed in public, the 1983 NBA All-Star Game at the Fabulous Forum.
And you have that juxtaposed with right after, very close to it in the play, with Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July. Let's talk about that juxtaposition.
Well, I think that Marvin Gaye, Michael, sings the Star-Spangled Banner unlike any other American. He gives it such nuance, such truth, that is undeniable to anyone who has the heart to listen. And he ran into the Forum, as the story goes, at the last second with a cassette tape as his backing track, and they had no idea what he was going to do, but it was Dr. J, who actually Julius Erving had to intercede on his behalf and say, hey, this is the man, this is the guy who's going to do it, because they had somebody else standing in the wings waiting to go on. And he runs in with a cassette tape, and boom, people are screaming. People are clapping. People are dancing. Unlike they had never responded to our national anthem before, which was a drinking song written by Francis Scott Key, right? Mm-hmm. All about bombs going off and, you know, very violent kind of martial drinking song. And Marvin transformed it into this amazingly sweet soul tune, as only Marvin could do.
And then you have Frederick Douglass's speech.
Yes, Frederick Douglass's classic speech, What to the American Slave is Your 4th of July, where he asks the question, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent have to do with your national independence? And he quotes from the Bible, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion, for there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? So we think about, yes, of course, that Frederick Douglass moment where one out of every seven Americans was enslaved. But we also think of the story of Marvin Gaye, who was singing that song for the world. And it was the last time that he would sing for the world. And he was taken out of the world by the same man who brought him in.
Let's talk about one thing that was really jarring to me. And I kept, whoa, wait a minute. Because it conjured up everything that I saw when I went down to Louisiana, when I went to New Orleans after Katrina, and what the entire world saw. You're taking people in this really just intense moment through the slave auction, and you bring in the Superdome, and then you're just like, you know, and then you go on, and I'm like, wait a minute, the slave just said the Superdome. Let's talk about that.
Well, Frederick Douglass Now, except for a prologue, which I have written, and an epilogue, which I wrote as well, is all in the words of Frederick Douglass, all in chronological order. The greatest challenge of this was editing these great speeches and editorials and letters into a, you know, palpable amount of time. It runs at 55 minutes now. But the idea of the Superdome, yes, of course, comes into play because Douglass is talking about following a drove of 100 men, women, and children from the Potomac River all the way down to the slave market at New Orleans. And he paints this horrid picture of the slave auction of people being sold and separated who loved each other, but they would never see each other again. And I slip in the word Superdome. I say, go to the Superdome, attend the slave auction. And I don't think that anyone who has a sense of American history was able to watch 9 years ago as New Orleans was flooded, the cradle of our civilization, as it were, was flooded. And there are lines upon lines upon lines of black people seeking solace in the Superdome, where they would meet all kinds of horrendous experiences, to be locked up in that fetid squalor in which black people normally entertain musically and athletically. And yet here are black people from New Orleans, which is the cradle of our American civilization, who have no better refuge from this flood than the Superdome. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me a legitimate juxtaposition. It's certainly what I thought about when I saw that.
Yeah, it's very powerful. When I was down there and I interviewed many, many people and just got a sense of what was happening to people, people who went to the Superdome, people who were forced to go there, people who were left outside there and facing down the police as they're trying to bring babies into the hospital, you know, being threatened with gunshot, being shot for being raised to the hospital or not being able to get food. You know, when you think about this, it also reminded me a lot of, you have a sentence in here. You have a statement. Is it Douglass' statement? I guess it is Douglass' statement. It's about the nation has placed one end of the chain
around the ankle of the black slave.
Man. Yeah.
And the other end around its own neck.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
That's MC Freddie D, quoted live and direct. Yeah, I mean, the future of the country, Douglass recognized as being inextricably tied with the future of black people in the country. And the people who built the country, of course, must be able to reap the benefits of their labor. But at that time, there was no possible way of that happening. There was the spark of hope during Reconstruction, but that spark of hope was betrayed by the rise of Ku Klux Klan, the rise of Jim Crow, the rise of apartheid, American style. As the story goes, no black people were in prison during slavery, but that switched off in the 20th century and now in the early part of the 21st century, in which formerly black majority states, an example, are now white majority states, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. How did that happen? How did black people who were in the majority, sometimes, for example, 12-1 in South Carolina, become a so-called minority group? That doesn't happen in four generations by magic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's a certain genocidal gesture which has been at play in this country for the last five generations.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to this next one. I had just spoken with Carl about this, but this was very heavy to me. The statement that what people will quietly submit to is an exact measure of the injustice and wrongs that will be heaped upon the oppressed. Who is to be free must strike the blow. Let's talk about that.
Well, this is the answer that Frederick Douglass had to the abolitionist establishment led by William Lloyd Garrison, who didn't feel that he should be speaking up on his own without the talking points from the abolitionist establishment, who didn't feel that he should be publishing his own press, who in fact felt that at one point that we should break away, meaning the United States should break away from the slaveholding states and say, no, you know, union with slaveholders. And Douglass saw that as insane, to simply let an entire portion of the country go because they were in opposition to your ethical and philosophical bent. He felt that it was the duty of all Americans to come to the liberation of the one out of seven Americans who were enslaved, no matter where they were enslaved.
Mm-hmm. He also had a tremendous and really healthy feeling about or admiration for John Brown, which was kind of interesting too in relation to all this.
John Brown drew up the plans for Harper's Ferry in Frederick Douglass's home, which made Frederick Douglass actually immediately a suspect. Mm-hmm. And there was a sympathetic telegraph operator in Philadelphia who delayed the warrant for Frederick Douglass's arrest and allowed him to go from his home in Rochester, New York, over the Canadian border and eventually to Britain, where he, you know, had to be in order to save his own life. And it's said that his very young daughter at that time was so traumatized by what had happened, not only to her father, but to Mr. Brown, who was a respected member of the household, that she died of trauma, of a broken heart. But John Brown wanted Douglass to go with him to Harper's Ferry and said, hey, you know, come on, come with me, Fred. And Douglass said, listen, you go ahead. I know that you're going to be a martyr and you're going to play your role and I'm going to play my role. And he continued to play his role until 1895.
Now I'm going to ask you one more question and we're running up on time, but I have to ask this because I know you've been doing this, you've been performing this play for 20 years or more. And I was going to, initially I was going to say, well, how has it developed? But then I realized when I looked at it and I realized the content of it and the context that it's being played out in, all the whenever you play it is actually constantly changing, but then still very much the same, rooted in the same thing. But you end this one with the, what is it, hashtag I can't breathe, which I just want you to talk about that for a minute.
No, it's not a hashtag. It's the last words of a man by the name of Eric Garner, who was saying quite simply, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And he breathed no more after that. Put into a chokehold by the NYPD. No one has been indicted thus far. As you say, only the man who took the videotape and his wife of the event have been arrested. This is one of the great struggles in this country to fight against state-sanctioned violence, whether it's violence against people in Staten Island or in Missouri or right here in L.A.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Roger Genver Smith about his play, Frederick Douglass Now. And for those of you who want to see the play but are not in an area where it's showing, you can Google it, and then it'll take you to YouTube, and you'll find a production of the play up there. You can watch it in its entirety. Don't miss it. It's a great play, all right? All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with the taste of a new song by J. Cole, Be Free.
And I'm in denial, and it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go, and it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no. And all we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is